Accession number 28639, Reel 2.
So.
And you didn't have to go down below, I
suppose.
No, I
didn't. I was up top. Well, my wireless operator was just down below the conning tower. But as I say, it didn't bother me. Although, claustrophobia, the wireless operator was just below the conning tower, and I could see, as long as I could see out, I was all right from claustrophobia. So if I was enclosed in any space. But this is, by the way, we took this house. My wife took this house because of my claustrophobic, which, they, again, the combat stress helped to cure me of. But I'll come to that later. But my wife took this because of the open staircase and that, and it was just open planning. It suited me fine, because of my claustrophobia. I would never go in a lift, by the way. No way would I go in a lift. No way. But I can now, after appearance at Leatherhead. Combat stress.
So now we're in the... I just want to make sure that the timeline... We're in the beginning of 1942, aren't we?
42, yes.
Right.
No, 41. 41 was... We declared war early... We only fought for 17 days. So if you can take 17 days away from Christmas Day, that'll give you an idea.
So that would be something like the sort of, you know, 6th of December, wouldn't it? It would be...
The 6th of December.
16,
yeah, it would be, that's right.
A bit later, or the 10th.
Late December, that's right, when the war was declared. I think it was the 8th, actually, of December, if I remember correctly. 6th or the 8th of December, when it was declared. And... I was on NTBs then. It was lovely. We were going to go out and chase the Japanese, and it was we used to go up the coast. And I remember coming back once. We had to, because the war was on, we had to fire a rocket, a Vera light, to let the Royal Artillery people who were on the entrance to Hong Kong Harbour know whether we were friend or foe. On one occasion, we were up the China Coast there on MTB Not 8, watching for the Shanhurst again, because we never did find her previously. And she was apparently in Vladivostok.
Now, this is the cruiser? This is the big...
No, not the battleship. This was the same name. She was a big armed merchant ship of the same name. And we were reported... This was one of the messages I got when we were out on the MTB, to go up into, have a look to see if we could see her in Vladivostok. Now, it meant going into the South China Sea, so up we went there. And on the way up, by the way, we had to refuel. Well, fortunately, the Apple Leaf, although I was no longer on it, was still in the area, so we refueled there.
At sea,
oh yes. And we went up into Vladivostok. Now, before we went in there...
To Vladivostok.
Sorry?
You went to Vladivostok.
Yes, we didn't go in there properly. I'll tell you what happened. The skipper said, now, how many of you know the Shanhurst? And there was one chap on the ship remembered her. He said, right. He said, if you can recognise her in the gloom, he said, well, go in, he says, on the very late night, just as it's getting dark. He says, I'll go in stern first, on a Mr. Torpedo boat. And he said, as soon as you recognise, you let me know and I'll open throttle and we'll be out as quick as we can. So when we went, stern on, not on the full engine, by the way, on, we have an auxiliary engine on these things, petrol-driven auxiliary engine. So we went in with her, very quietly, into Vladivostok. And they spotted her. So out we went. But as we saw full throttle, the searchlights came on to us and they followed us out. And the Japanese equivalent of the motor torpedo boats and our destroyer followed us out, but they couldn't catch us. We were out, we were away, we got away with that.
And the idea was just to locate the ship, not to torpedo
it? No, just to make sure she was there so that we knew where she was. So we managed to do that. On the way back, we had to come straight back then to Hong Kong. But on the way back, we'd run out of food. So we pulled into the China Coast. And because I had to have a wireless communication every 2 hours with Hong Kong. So said we need butter and eggs. So we'll let the coxswain and I never got on, by the way. And apparently that was quite common in motor torpedo boats. The coxswain didn't like us having so much communication, direct communication with the officer in charge. And I was sort of, we found a squadron sergeant was in between him, the coxswain, and the, he was a petty officer, of course, and I was just a rating. So they didn't like, we never got on with them. So he sent me ashore, and on this little rubber boat, which we had to blow up, and the Chinese cook came with me, because he could speak Chinese fluently. So off we went. I had to paddle this thing ashore, and we pulled it up onto the beach, and then we went inland looking for a village to get what we wanted. And when we came back, an hour later...
You found the village. Yeah, go on.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, we might have found the village, and we just crossed the Chinese, got what we wanted, Chinese cook. But when we came back, the sea had gone out, and it was, oh, good several hundred yards away. And it was all mud. So we were up to the ankles in mud trying to get back to the sea with this little rubber dinghy. Consequently, by the time we got back to the boat, we pulled up alongside the boat, and the coxswain was there waiting for me. He said, still covered in mud, waiting up to... He said, get your cap. I looked at him in amazement. Get your cap, you're on a charge. This is true, as I've said to you. He said, you're on a charge for deserting your post. He says, you should have been here to do your communications with Hong Kong. So anyway, I was on the charge, straight away, of course, and our skipper, who I used to sit beside, looked at me and he could say, he was an RNVR, by the way, with a regular naval coxswain, which didn't help matters any. And the coxswain read out the charge, and asked then the skipper said to me, what's your explanation? So I said, well, I explained. I said, I was told because I didn't have a communication for 2 hours, I was the one that sent them both. I said, I complained at the time about it, but I was overruled. I still had to go. So he said, well, he said, I don't know what to do about this. He says, we'll have to leave it until you get back into Hong Kong. So that was his only way out of it, really, the captain. I felt sorry for him.
That you are sitting in this.
So he said, you'll be on house arrest now. He said, you still do your duty. So he said, I suggest you get on to Hong Kong straight away and just explain the situation. So I did this, and I could imagine what the wireless operator on the other side was saying when they communicated out with them. Anyway, as we approached Hong Kong, of course, I hadn't done any of my other duties, was to change... part of my duties was also to change the Vera lights, you see, and I hadn't done this, of course, because I was still under house arrest. So when we approached Hong Kong, we got this flashing light, and of course, we didn't answer it first, and then we had a shot over our bows, and the skipper said to the coxswain, well, you've got the Vera lights, he said, we can't use the wireless operator because he's under house arrest. So the coxswain came up and said, where's the Vera lights? So I told him where they were, and he fired the Vera lights. Of course, there was a shower of firing. So, of course, then the skipper said, what the hell's going on? I said, you've got the wrong Vera lights. I said, the coxswain, I said, is responsible for this. I said, he wouldn't allow me to do my duties. So I very quickly gave him the correct one. And, of course, I had to do it several times before they'd allow us in. And eventually we got back in. And I was put on a charge, but of course I got off straight away. I mean,
and what about the coxswain? Wasn't he put on a charge?
Well, no, I don't know what happened to him, but we were still on the same boat. And war was really on now, so we were just... charges were really forgotten about. We were back on duty again, really, all of us. And we were posted round to Aberdeen Harbour. This was the Japs really were really hitting us for six by this time.
I mean, were you aware now that it was the end? That really the whole place was going to
be overrun? Oh, yeah. We knew any time now the Japs were going to cross from Kowloon. They'd already taken over Kowloon, and that's where we were transferred to the other side of the island, the seaward side, Aberdeen Harbour, where there was a small naval base there, a very small one at the time. And we were there. Now, we carried on our duties from Aberdeen, and on one occasion, we're out on the way back. We hadn't seen anything, by the way, of interest on this occasion. We came back, and on the way in, one of the propellers, which was quite a common thing, broke loose or was damaged. We must have hit something. And the whole boat shuddered because it was unbalanced with three propellers, only two working, one not, or one spinning round not working. So when we got into harbour, we were still fully loaded with torpedoes and ammunition, like depth charge and what have you, and three full tanks of diesel fuel. But because it was in the middle of war, they didn't. Before we pulled up on a slipway, we were supposed to de-ammunition. But because the war was on, we left everything on board. We pulled that up on the slipway with a pit underneath the slipway, so that they could get in and work on the propellers. Normally at sea, my job to dive overboard and find out which propeller it was broken, so they could switch off that engine and use the other two to get in. But now that war was on, that was forgotten. We were up on this slipway, and the crew went up into the little naffy we had there to have breakfast. The two seamen staying on board were down in the pit to repair the broken propeller. While we were up in the canteen having breakfast, there was another air raid, and it was a tremendous explosion. And we all ran down because the only thing we could think of was our boat. We ran down and we couldn't find a piece of our boat anywhere. It just disappeared. They were direct hit. But the two seamen were still in the pit, huddled in a corner. They both had helmets on, with dented helmets. But they were still both alive, deaf as doornail. Both of them were immediately taken to the naval hospital. I never saw them again. But from then on, I was just a wireless operator. So they gave me a job as a personal wireless operator, Major Giles of the Royal Marines. But this time the Japs had landed on Hong Kong Island. And I was up on Bennett's Hill in the front line with my portable radio set as the wireless operator, the personal wireless operator, this Major Giles.
This again was a Morse.
This again just Morse, yeah. We had the key and everything. And he had a detachment of Gurkhas and Royal Marines, so I couldn't be behind a better clan of people than Gurkhas and Marodi. But down the left-hand side, that was on the China side of Bennett's Hill, we had Canadians. They'd just come in, apparently, as war was declared, and none of them had ever used a rifle, let alone they'd just been given them without any training. So we were up on this Bennett's Hill, and the war was on by now, of course, and it was pretty hectic. And they were coming up, the Japs they'd landed on the island, on the north side of the island, and they were coming up the hill, to Bennett's Hill, at us. And we never, by the way, moved from that Bennett's Hill right up until we surrendered. These Gurkhas, and they were coming up the hill, the Japs, and as we were shooting them, they were either dead or lying wounded. And the other Japs coming up would just use even their wounded comrades as sandbags and just lying behind them firing at us. And I could see all this, although I didn't have any ammunition. I could see all this happening in daylight. But at night time, it was even worse. Someone told us at night time, the Japanese can't see very well, so you won't have any problem at night. But they were firing bullets at night, and they were what do you call it, bullets? They light up.
Tracer.
Straighter bullet, that's right. One went through, by the way, I'd still had my naval blue jacket on, and I had to change it, but I didn't have time to change my uniform into an army one, because I was still Navy, so I had to wear a khaki overcoat, a sort of a, I don't know what they call them now, but it was with a hood on it, and the things with the little tussles came across with a hook.
Duffel
coat. We had to wear a khaki duffel coat.
In the tropics.
In the tropics, yes, it didn't help. I had to wear this. And that didn't help when I had to move, because every now and again, of course, we had to move to positions, and I had to dismantle my set and follow the captain, the Royal Marine captain. Major Giles, he was named, Giles. Now, he was very good to me, really. He gave me time. He said, I'll give you as much warning as I can before I move. But on one occasion, when the Japs were pretty close up on us, they had broken behind this Canadian left flank we had. and he had to stop them. So off he went. It was the middle of the night when this happened. With the stress of bullets, off he went and left me on my own. And I was busy trying to dismantle my set. By the time I'd got it ready to get into my pack and follow him, they'd all gone. And I was lying there alone, really, with just a few Gurkhas who I couldn't speak to because they were still holding the fort. He had taken this part of the Gurkha detachment and the Marines with him to try and plug the gap. Left me on my own. So I was lying there, and after hours lying there, I decided I'd had enough because I didn't know what was happening. I couldn't use the radio because I'd dismantled it, or I couldn't put it up again because I had to get orders to do this. So I decided to get rid of my set, so I smashed with my hands the bulbs, all bulbs in those days, smashed the radio set as best I could, and I started to roll down the hill, as I can remember, into the Repulse Bay side of Bennett's, or the Aberdeen side of it. I kept rolling down this hill, and every time I heard snap, twig snap, I panicked because the Japanese footwear were rubber boots, and you couldn't hear them. And I thought it was a Japanese, but each time I lied and didn't hear any noise, I read on. I finished up down in the Taifu ditch. There's ditches for the typhoons that I used to have there, the monsoon ditch, they called them. And I was lying there, still darkness, wondering what to do next. I didn't know which way to go, where were the Japs, where I'd lost my bearings a bit. So I was lying there, I say, and it was still complete darkness. And eventually I decided I had to go and try something. But as I was moving to get out, I could hear Japanese voices. So I thought, oh my God. So back I went into the ditch again, and I lay there motionless. The Japanese voices got louder and louder until they were right opposite me, and they stopped. And then I was conscious of them coming down at the ditch, and I thought, this was it. They pricked me with a bayonet, and of course I tried to lay as stiff as I could. And they took my wristwatch off, they went through my pockets, and every time they lifted my hand, I kept it as limp as I could, and I let it go. And eventually, they got up and left me, and off they went. And I just couldn't, you'll find out why I was really in trouble, because it was getting daylight by this time. I was still lying there pretending I was dead. But as daylight approached, I could see other bodies lying beside me, and I'd been lying on top of dead Japanese soldiers. And suddenly I heard English voices, and I heard the marching of the old army boots. So I jumped out this trench, and I saw them coming to me. I ran towards this big burly sergeant. I'll never forget this. And I jumped into his arms, because I was only a young boy at the time. And he said, Jesus Christ, that was his exact words. Where the hell have you been? You're pong like bloody hell. And he turned to the corporal. He said, get this lad back into the billet, he says, and get him a bath and a change of clothing. I had to shit myself. And I didn't know I'd done it, honestly. So back I went. And the little sick bay there, which was the victim of my stupidity, really, later on, as you'll find out. They'd give me a bath of nurses there and give me a change of clothing. But I still had to wear my blue suit because it was only my underwear that was there. So I just finished that when another court-martial appeared before me. This time, my officer came, my so-called Marine officer, Major Giles. He came and he said, get your cap. He said, you're on a charge. I said, what the hell for? He said, don't speak to me like that. You're on a charge, that's it. So, fortunately, it was done again quickly because the war was on, and the sergeant had come in, fortunately for me at the time, to see how I was. And he heard of all this. He said, good God, he says, you don't want to tell me, he says, in the middle of a war, you're going to charge this young lad with what? What are you going to charge him with? He said, deserting his post. He says, and he told them what had happened. And immediately he apologised, this Major Giles did. He said, right, he said, get yourself another radio set as quickly as possible and be with me he says, as soon as you can. And that was it. So I got my...
But, I mean, technically, because you had no orders and you were stuck in the fort, you did the right thing by destroying a radio and getting out.
Yes, that's right. But, of course, they hadn't got round to that because the so-called court-martial didn't take charge because, thanks to the sergeant, he came in and saved my life, really. God knows what would have happened, because in those days you could be treated as a cowardice, like the news you just heard of somebody just now, the court case up for trying to get someone who was treated, charged with cowardice in the First World War and got shot it down. Mm. So I just didn't know whether they were still doing that or not. So, but anyway, what happened then was I was back up on Bennett's Hill again. But almost on the same position I was originally. Where we're back, we had really covered that gap, and I think some of the HMS Thracian Navy boys who had survived the massacre, apparently, they had taken over the plot where the Japs had broken through. They had sealed it up again.
Sorry, these were the HMS Thracian?
HMS Thracian was a destroyer. She was the only destroyer left when the Japs declared HMS Thracian. And they ran aground, apparently, eventually, during the war, on the entrance to Hong Kong. And the naval transport that came to get the survivors, the first lot was massacred by the Japanese as they were taking them away. The second lot managed to get out, and the remainder of the crew just joined up with the army and helping to defend the island, really.
Well, the Japanese captured this transport and just killed everyone on it.
Well, no, there were groups of snipers that had penetrated the lines and were hiding themselves. There might have been a lot of these fifth columnist types, really, who, as you probably gathered from the history of Hong Kong, they were there in civilians long before the Japs attacked us. So it could have been them, but it was a Japanese ambush, I can assure you. In Lime Bay, it was called, where the Thracian went down, or went on the rocks.
Thracian, how would that be spelled? T-H-R-A-C?
T-H-R-A-C-I-A-N, Thracian. T-H-R-A-C-I-A-N, Thracian. And they plugged the gap, so we were back to normal again. And again, the firing day and night, until suddenly I got this instruction to Major Giles, to lay down our arms and return to base in Aberdeen. At first he ignored it. He says, tell them to get lost. So I said, how can I tell the Commodore, who was in charge of that, to get lost? He said, well, tell them, no way am I surrendering while we are still holding our position. So eventually the signal came back through, ordering him to do so. He said, you'd like to know that they've now bombed the reservoir and there's no water, and we have a tremendous amount of Chinese population on this island, and they are going without water, and that's dangerous. So we're surrendering. So back we came into the Aberdeen naval base, as it was called, a small base.
And did they lay down their weapons and leave them in the...
Oh, room? Yes. We brought them back into the base. All the Gurkhas and the Royal Marines and a lot of the naval people all came back into the base from Aberdeen, from the Bennett's Hill, back into the naval base at Aberdeen.
And how long was that, a half-hour march?
Just a couple of hours.
And what was the...
Because we had to come back quite away from Bennett's Hill, you see, it was quite downhill, and it was a lot of them were carrying stuff. We had taken food rather than everything, as you can imagine.
And what was the... ambience? What was the morale, I suppose? Everyone
it was
desperate.
Pretty desperate. Nobody talked, really. We just were doing what we're told. We couldn't believe it because we were holding our line. Back we came and we were inside. And when we got into Aberdeen Base, the people before us had already put their arms in the middle of a little parade ground in this Aberdeen Naval Base. Small parade ground it was. And it was this heaped up of arms. So I just threw my radio set on top of this lot. And we're all gathered. There must have been about 30 of us, certainly not much more than that, 30 of us there at the time, waiting for the Japs to come in. And suddenly the Japs came bouncing in, banzai, banzai, with the rifles up. It's the first time I'd actually been confronted with one physically. And one of them grabbed me and said, hospital, hospital, where's your hospital? So I said, no hospital, this naval base. And I couldn't find anyone to help me out with the Japanese. So I said, but we have naval They will sick bay. I said, yes, sick. Ah, sick. He said, where? I said, pointing to Red Cross. I said, that Red Cross over there, that's our sick bay. It was the worst thing I ever did, because they went across and they dragged out these bloody nurses. And excuse me getting choked up, because it's one of the two things I shall never forget. They pulled these poor five nurses out, and it was quite horrendous. It was quite awful. They queued up, raping them one after the other. All these Japanese just queued up to rape these. And as they were doing it, they were telling them, I hate to be graphic about it, but I have to tell you how awful it was. And we had to stand there because the other Jap guards had machine guns on us, and they just stood there, pointing the machine gun. There was nothing we could do about it. It was quite awful, really, to watch this. And I felt to think I was responsible for all this. And eventually, of course, they succumbed to it. And they let the girls go. But to this day, I don't know what happened to those poor girls. But
they were
frothing at the mouth. I stand watching this. They were glassy-eyed, screaming and foaming at the mouth. It must have been just wholly terrifying.
The girls were screaming, or the Japanese?
The Japanese were making these banzai, you know, noises as they were doing it, and the girls were screaming.
They
so
were
it was
English
a mixture
girls?
Of screams from the girls. Well, not as far as I know, five of them survived. But I'll tell you quickly, I did meet one of them later in life at one of the Far East prisoner of war reunions in Bournemouth. And she was still alive, and I met her, and she was in her late 70s at that time. I can't remember her name, but I remember when I was introduced to her, she said, my God, you weren't in Hong Kong. I said, yes, I was. And she said, you weren't in Aberdeen. I said, yes, I was. She said, oh, my God. And I said, don't tell me you were one of them. And she said, yes, I was. I said, how did you manage to survive? She said, I don't know, but I've never married. She said, I just couldn't. She said, I just couldn't. I've just spent the rest of my life, she says, nursing, really. And I said, what about the others? She says, well, one of them, who is still alive, had a baby of all that. And as far as I know, and this was her words, as far as I know, she never could marry, and she's never told her son who the father was. And she's, as far as I know, she put him out to, what do they call it,
adoption.
One of these homes. And I thought, that's awful. So that was the sort of experience I had during the war in Hong Kong. But then, of course, we were taken out of Aberdeen and put on a transport and taken into Hong Kong itself.
And I suppose you were also shocked by this experience.
Oh, yeah, I was still suffering from that.
You must have all...
Oh, it was awful. I'll tell you, I was only a young boy, remember. And in those days, 20 years of age was much younger than 20 years of age today, because they grow up so quickly today. And I was still sobbing and upset about it all. I was still in the same frame of mind when I eventually arrived in Sham Shui Po prison camp in Kowloon.
How long?
That was in the same day, later that day. It was getting into the evening. They had taken us across on one of the star ferries and put us in the Sham Shui Po camp.
And were they brutal with you?
Oh, yes, on the way across. Oh, yes, they were. If you didn't do what they... you couldn't understand their orders. We couldn't help it. We didn't understand orders. They used to beat us up for not understanding. They used to beat us and then show us what to do. They were really very evil people. They were sadistic, really. And when I got into Sham Shui Po camp, and I lay there on my bed space, a concrete flooring, by the way. It was an old immigration centre, apparently. It was used by the immigration people in Hong Kong. And it had taken over this one. The barbed wire fences all around it. There were several huts. And I had to sleep on this concrete flooring. One blanket we had. We either lay on it or wrapped ourselves in it.
How many of you were there in this camp?
There must have been getting on for... Oh, I'm only guessing now. Several thousand, probably in the region of 20,000, I would have thought, in this camp.
That.
In the region of that. It must have been that.
A mixture of soldiers.
Soldiers, yeah, they were all, yeah, that's right.
Naval people.
More of the garrison. and some of the Chinese. So there was only about 10,000, I believe, garrison in Hong Kong at the time. But there was the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Force, and all the other volunteers had come into the war during the actual war period.
Jack Hewison, Reel 2.